From WXXI News, this is Education Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, on this Education Friday, our conversation to start this hour is made in the classroom. Specifically, how flexible can teachers be? Are new curriculum standards impacting the ability and the agility of teachers that you're hearing about? Well, we're going to take a kind of a different look this hour. What about when it comes to trying new ideas? In many ways, it's a difficult time for public school teachers. They've been told they shouldn't fear reprisal if they speak their minds on certain issues. But our first conversation this hour is with a private school teacher who perhaps maybe does have more flexibility. His name's Seth O'Brien. My guest is not only a teacher at the Harley School, but the Commons Coordinator. And I guess we're going to find out what that means, Seth, aren't we, in just a second. Nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start with the notion of flexibility in general, because right now, look, you're not here to speak against public schools. I mean, we've had lots of conversations with our friends from Allendale, Columbia, Harley, and you know, your job is not to denigrate public schools. I know you're just offering an alternative, but at the same time, the rules are a little different for you. Is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. So when it comes to flexibility, give me your background as a teacher. You've been at Harley for how long?
Well, one thing is I am a proud product of public schools as well. So it's kind of an important piece of who I am.
Okay.
This is my fifth year at the Harley School and my 15th year of teaching. And I teach math and I work in this building called the Commons, where there's a lot of green technology and students are working with the rest of the community to try and get to net zero energy use in the building. And we host a ton of other centers and interesting activities. But one big thing I wanted to say, when I hear the phrase flexibility in curriculum with Harley, I actually think of like two different strands of thought. One, in the traditional classroom sense, like math, English, history, science, international world language, flexibility for teachers to bring in their own curriculum and their own interest, flexibility to assess students in ways that, you know, it doesn't have to be a traditional test. They can have a project, they can do a debate, we can do all kinds of different types of authentic assessment. So you have flexibility in the traditional classroom sense. And then also Harley has a lot of kind of flexibility in terms of other types of classes. So I teach a class called Living Building, where I work with students to really figure out the net zero challenge, look at energy use throughout the building, look at specific circuits, look at how much the solar panels are producing, and then meet with other classes and talk about how they're using energy in the building. We have a hospice class that I think that's fairly unique.
A hospice class?
Yeah, where students actually go learn hospice care and then work in hospice houses in the Rochester area.
Wow.
In lower school, we have a thing we've been doing for a couple of years called Harlic, where students work with you could sort of call our sustainability coordinator, to create their own garlic shop, basically. And they plant the garlic, and then they make T-shirts and logos, and then actually sell the garlic to our community.
Kind of an entrepreneurial experience?
Yeah. So we have these two different strands of flexibility in the curriculum.
Well, and you've given us a lot to touch on, a lot of different branches that we can kind of walk out on in this discussion. But maybe I should back up and just ask you, how do you define, as a teacher, how do you define what flexibility means in the classroom? Because some people will say, look, you can't be so flexible that you are blowing up basic teaching standards and doing whatever you want. But I guess some people would say, to some degree, you have to have that a lot of leeway. How do you define flexibility?
I'm going to go with a dual theme a lot, I think, for the next whatever minutes.
Okay.
So when you say that, you know, maybe in a half an hour, I'd change my answer. But when I hear your question, to me, at the heart of the question is, there's flexibility from the teacher sense of, can I be myself in the classroom? Can I teach the content that I believe is essential for this discipline? Can I assess the students in ways that I think are important and meaningful? But then at the same time, that's not good enough. Can I be flexible to adapt what I do to the different students' needs? So you have to, like, to me, flexibility on the one hand is the teacher, and on the other hand, it's understanding the different types of students you have in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting point. What about when it comes to testing? Do you get the sense that there's a certain rigidity to what is expected in testing and evaluation, or is there flexibility there?
At Harley, there's flexibility. There's still, I'm a math teacher, so there's still kind of a common sense of what is Algebra 2,
sure,
what
absolutely.
Is pre-calc.
Absolutely.
I think what's hard is actually writing tests that assess critical thinking skills, both in terms of giving the kids chances to think about problems from different ways, and then how do you, without just a black and white, like this is right answer, wrong answer, or you know the traditional partial credit, how do you really give students credit for critical thinking skills is a really difficult thing to do. And so you can see why creating a authentic assessment to examine how students can use critical thinking skills is a huge challenge.
And I think that's a big part of the discussion in public schools,
right,
and that kind of testing. Are you staying as far away from that as possible because it doesn't necessarily impact you, or do you monitor what's going on?
I like to read the news, and this particular topic is kind of interesting with the role of politics in education as well. But going back to my life at Harley, I think I have my own personal challenge of how do I write fair tests? And I have the flexibility in the classroom to kind of make my own tests that I want. And I still a lot of times look at my tests and I say, man, this is a very traditional, simplistic, right or wrong, x equals 3 or x equals 5 type of, you know, question. And that's a little bit out of balance of how much I want to do that. So we all, separate from Big Brother coming down on us and telling what we have to do internally, we face our own challenges.
When it comes to, though, that critical thinking component, I have to think that assessing math has changed in some ways, and boy, I am not the person to be talking about this, but I struggled so much in math in high school, I was just trying to scrape by. But, you know, when you and I were in school, it was probably the TI-81 was this big deal, right?
Right.
And now students feel that they can get answers pretty quickly with technology. I don't know if that's true, but has that changed the way we assess them?
I give a lot of credit to Texas Instruments. I'm not affiliated with them. So
you're not here giving an ad for them?
I wish I was. Right. Getting a little stipend for that comment. But
sure.
The newest calculator they have is called the TI Inspire. And it has the ability, it can do basically the equivalent of Microsoft Excel, what we call Geometer Sketchpad, which is a very dynamic, interactive geometry program, traditional calculator work, traditional graphing work, and you have the ability to take different pages and really put them together, almost like a booklet of mathematics, and make it all connect. So the technology is fascinating, intimidating, with the right teacher and right professional development, creates the opportunity to do some really interesting investigations.
It's a misunderstanding to think that technology enables students not to learn then, right? Because learning how to function within the technology is probably still an important skill. Is that fair to say?
The more complicated the technology, the more you have to learn how to actually use the technology. And it's intimidating. And it's harder for the teacher to learn how to use the calculator as an investigative tool rather than an answer-making machine.
That makes me wonder, for you as an educator in a private school, how do I want to phrase this question? Do you feel the pull to constantly stay on top of technology? You'd say it's intimidating, maybe for students, but I have to think occasionally technology can be intimidating for teachers, because you could get into a routine with what is comfortable, with what you have always done, with what you've always known, and you could allow the technology to sort of, at least the newer iterations, to pass you by. And how much is there more pressure for a private school teacher to make sure that complacency doesn't happen?
That's a long question.
Does it make sense?
I think so. I had a thought in my head and I got distracted a little bit though.
By the length of my question?
Well, I think that at the end of the day, we have the standard to be exceptional teachers. We are very aware of the best practices that are out there through talking to colleagues, mm-hmm. through literature, through going to conferences. And once we see what's out there, we challenge ourselves to, if it's relevant to what we're trying to accomplish, to learn more about that thing. But the thing about technology, to get away from the calculator for a minute, make it more interesting to more people, We have this software in our new building that measures the energy use in each circuit in the entire building. So it'll say something like channel 32 is using, 1.2 kilowatts per hour. And, it doesn't say outlet and corner uses
right.
all of that energy.
Right, right.
So we were recently, some students and I were recently doing an activity of trying to figure out, okay, the software says this channel uses this much energy, but I'm not sure which set of outlets it is in the space or if it's the projector. So we did a couple different, investigations to try and figure out which, is it that outlet over there that's using a lot of energy, or is it this broken computer that's using a lot of energy? And there were a few times where we didn't figure out the answer. And so part of what's scary about using technology is, what if you do something in class with it and it doesn't work, or you can't use it correctly and you get stuck? What happens when the lesson goes awry is part of one of the biggest fears about technology. And the upshot of that is, if you can think about it from the right angle and stay calm as a teacher, it's an incredible learning opportunity where you're modeling for your student, what do you do when things go wrong? How do you problem solve? And then secondly, the importance of being able to collaborate with a 15-year-old or a 12-year-old or an 80-year-old is an important skill, because sometimes Timmy, the 12-year-old, actually can figure out better than you what the right thing to do is.
They are really remarkable, especially when it comes to grasping technology.
Right.
Amazing, aren't they?
Absolutely. And that's kind of one of the challenges for curriculum now, is kids are growing up in kind of a different environment. And often education is kind of slow moving to change and adapt to what's out there. I mean, there's a lot of things we still do from centuries ago. So how does the curriculum adapt to, kids who are growing up with Twitter, Facebook, phones, all the other jazz from the time they're four,
Right. That's ingrained in their day-to-day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear how technology has really changed since Seth and I were in school. Yeah,
absolutely.
We're talking to Seth O'Brien. My guest now is a teacher and the Commons Coordinator at the Harley School. We're talking about, among other things, flexibility in education. And Amy writes that, "My daughter goes to public schools, and I feel like there is no flexibility. It's nice to hear that some teachers have that privilege, but I don't think most do anymore." And I think Amy's talking again about public schools. I know you've heard that, and again, Seth is a private school teacher, but let me ask you then a philosophical question based on Amy's comment there. What are the risks of boxing teachers in too much?
I think teachers across the United States of America are going to be irritated by this comment I'm going to make, but I think it's good sometimes for parents to ask their children's teachers, how is it going? Like, what are some of your strategies for implementing critical thinking into my classroom? How is my child doing? What can I do at home to help my child become better at math or more creative, or what can I do to supplement your curriculum? Because there are a lot of really gifted teachers out there, and there are many gifted teachers who, whatever boxed in they are still creative enough, brilliant enough to
work
be
within
amazing
that structure.
Teachers. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then also there are probably some things one could do at home to supplement the challenges that they may face.
I don't think you offended that many people. I think what you're saying, though, is parental sort of initiative.
I'm just saying the fear of, I'm not, like, teachers sometimes have this fear, am I going to open my email and have 37 emails from people with concerns about what I'm doing or questions?
You mean angry parents?
Not angry. I'm just saying I think when I have, when my daughter is in school, I think I'm going to be that parent that teachers start to dread my name coming up in their inbox because I'm going to have so many questions. I think that conversation is really helpful for our children between parents and teachers, but it can be a little bit overwhelming when you're already a very busy teacher.
But this is a very interesting point that you're making, because this is not the same as, I saw a cartoon that's been going on social media that is aiming to illustrate the difference in education from 40 years ago to today.
Uh-huh.
And it says 40 years ago, a child gets a bad report card and the parent's reaction is, what did you do wrong to the child? And now a child gets a bad report card and the parent's reaction is, what did you do wrong to the teacher? And that's a big generalization. You're not advocating that parents sort of overly police not be overly critical, but just more involved, more inquisitive?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the conversation and collaboration about how can I best help my child succeed in school and get a maximum experience is a great conversation to have.
But you're a teacher and you're welcoming that. Do most teachers welcome that?
I think so. I mean, at the end of the day, most teachers, if not all, want their students to succeed. And sometimes there's that one little nugget that a parent has to offer that you didn't see in terms of their child, and knowing that piece of information is really helpful. Sometimes there's that one little skill that, you know, that Malcolm could be practicing at home, that if he was doing that math little extra practice, things would work a lot better in the classroom. So that conversation between parent and teacher, it is often the case there could be more of that. And I think that what you hear is by the time students are in high school, parents have this feeling that they're supposed to be more hands-off. More hands-off, yes, but not hands-off. And I think collaboration and conversation is really, really important. And that is something we work hard at the Harley School, of like, our inboxes and ears are open and let us know what we can do to support your child. And I think that's important.
Interesting conversation here with Seth O'Brien, a teacher and the Commons Coordinator at the Harley School. If you want to join the conversation, as several of you are jumping in on Twitter, it's at Evan Dawson on Twitter. The number is toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. What are your thoughts about flexibility in education, the value of flexibility, the role of the parent, parental involvement, as Seth is bringing up here? And, you know, I've heard about things at Harley that foster some of these things. Project X Days, for example. Tell me about that.
So fortunately, I am involved with Project X. That's a lower school project activity. The first couple years of doing it, it was whole lower school. So
when you say lower school, though, by the way,
sorry,
for our public school audience,
yep.
Little bit of the framework.
Lower school is the typical independent school term for elementary school. Varies kind of. At Harley, it's Project X was actually kind of pre-K through fourth grade. And so there were different groups that would include first graders and fourth graders and third graders. And there would be some kind of question or topic and some kind of initial presentation, and then a lot of different totally exploratory activities to try and learn more about the question or topic. Students would often create something. Work together in these groups. We would just give them a bunch of supplies that they would kind of put them together and make something to blow bubbles or move a little car in some water, and very open-ended.
Sounds like a lot of this is open-ended, though. I mean, that sounds like a theme.
Yeah, absolutely. With a balance of plenty of one answer is correct type of instruction as well. But it is very important that we include enough of the open-ended to have the balance.
All right, we're going to get to your phone calls in just a second. I see the phone ringing. If you want to join the conversation with Seth O'Brien, you can do that as we talk about flexibility in education. By the way, you mentioned you're the Commons Coordinator.
Uh-huh.
That's another term. Another brief explanation, if you could, about what the Commons is.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. So I'm going to kind of keep it a little bit concrete. In the Commons, there are three floors. On the bottom floor, we have a workshop with a lot of tools for kind of hands-on construction. There's kind of a design thinking approach. And then there's another big room that's just for projects. It's got kind of some drainage in there and sinks so you can get messy and try stuff out. There's a greenhouse on the second floor. We have two classrooms. On the third floor, we have what's called the Center for Mindfulness and Empathy Education, which hosts hospice class, but a lot of other kind of mindfulness exercises. And then we have a big space called the Center for Civic Engagement, where we, again, classrooms, lectures, for example, upcoming lecture. We have a new speaker series this year called the Commons Series. Jack Barron will be talking about Sugar is the New Oil. So, again, just kind of a big lecture. It's a really cool space, though. And hopefully all that energy will be kind of solar driven. So we have, I believe, 88 solar panels on the roof. There are a lot of stretches in the day where we're actually creating more energy than we use. So those are some highlights about what's in there. I'm sure I'm forgetting about 12. Some geothermal.
You'll remember as the hour goes. Actually, you'll probably remember most of them after, as soon as we get off the air. interesting stuff. Lauren online writes that I recently retired from teaching at the age of 33. She says there is no flexibility allowed because if something we try doesn't work, we're in trouble. And that's an interesting comment, Seth, because the notion of flexibility has to include some allowance for failure, for teachers to try something new, whether it's an approach to testing, an approach to teaching and learning, whatever it is. But do you feel any pressure that if you try something that I imagine you have tried things that you don't think work as well as you had envisioned? And what happens in that scenario?
Well, it's funny you say this. And this isn't really a great help for Lauren here, but the other day, Amy Lewis, our director of communications, came up and mentioned me being here today for your show, and I had just gotten out of what I would think of as one of my worst teaching performances in 15 years. So there is plenty of room for error in
Do you want to specify, by the way?
It was just one of those things where I just didn't teach a concept well because I wasn't well prepared and kids were confused and I was frustrated with myself. It was just a math SAT skill. But the beauty of teaching is, you know, if it doesn't go well one day, you get up and you go and you teach the next day. And kids in general are incredibly open-minded if you demonstrate that you care and are committed and are going to work hard. So the beauty of being able to get up the next day and plug away and do something better is really important.
But you have both the self-awareness and the leeway,
right,
to confront the fact that something you tried didn't work, and you don't fear for your job, you don't fear,
right,
you know, especially, again, I'm thinking of public school teachers who are untenured, for example, but you don't feel that pressure, it doesn't look like.
No, I think what you see, yeah, the advantage of independent school these days in particular is you don't have this performance-based pay or evaluations that are tied to test scores, and that's just a complicated, challenging subject. For us in independent school, most of the critical voice is our own, and overcoming that sometimes is kind of challenging in itself. So that is a nice thing for us. But what's interesting with Common Core, and I don't really want to talk much about it because I realize I'm an independent school teacher, but reading the news, it's interesting that the politics and the community, you're hearing a lot of different voices, and it does seem like in the big picture, people are trying to work toward what works best for the kids.
Sure. I think it's hard to argue that point.
Right.
But I think, yeah, the question is, you know, what's effective, and are we allowed to sort of confront that? Let's grab a phone call. This is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting the way JFK's parents taught critical thinking to their family. At mealtimes, they discussed politics and history, current events, and the children were taught to argue their points, and they could come to any conclusion, you know, it would be acceptable and respected, but they had to support it. You couldn't just, announce a certain conclusion that you have about an issue without supporting it. And it was a very good way, I thought, to teach critical thinking and that habit of that. So the parents were very much involved in setting the example and showing, and also respect, you know, be courageous and say what you have to say, and others may differ, but you can support what you say, and they can learn from you what you're basing that on. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. What do you think, Seth?
I think that's an awesome point, obviously. I agree totally. I think the more you can have the tough conversations with your children about world events, about arguing your point, about being able to listen to others, about talking about what did we do in English class today, about having your kid try and teach you the Pythagorean theorem is just great stuff.
Are you familiar with the book A More Beautiful Question?
No.
Okay. So it's like, well, thanks for bringing something up. No, I just bring it up because Jane's point there put my brain down that road, which is the notion that kids, and I'm probably going to bungle a little bit of a summation because anytime you summarize something that's kind of complex, there's some danger there. But the general idea is that kids have to learn how to think critically, to ask the right questions to get good answers. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, technology is helpful, but I can think in journalism throughout my career. I've worked with interns who are remarkably, I don't mean to be crude or unfair, but remarkably inept at even using Google to find a series of answers for investigative pieces that we're doing. And you'd think that, boy, I didn't grow up with a search engine, but at the same time, you have to be able to think critically on how to find, how to go down certain roads, how to think critically. What are your thoughts on the value and the challenge in teaching kids how to ask the right question?
This is a great point and a good transitional moment for me, because your comments make me think about another piece of our building, which is called a solar chimney. And a solar chimney can take kind of the passive heat from the sun, and you can try and move it throughout your building using some convection principles. And I'm working with a student on trying to figure out how to actually use that thing. And so we stand there and we say, there's the solar chimney. Now, where do we go? So this is exactly what you're talking about. Like, what questions do we need to ask to figure out what our next steps are for how to test this out? So you can open and close certain vents. We can look at the temperature in the rooms. We can look at what the heat is, what the sun is doing on a given day, and then try and figure out what things to open and close to move the heat throughout the building, or in the summer, the cool air throughout the building. And we've talked to different wise people about this, like what should be open and closed when it's on heating mode, and different brilliant people say different brilliant things. So then we've got to figure out, we can test these things out, but how do we even test to make sure it's working? There's not a device that tells you this solar chimney is useful or not, because you have other heating and cooling instruments going on at the same time. So this is me and a 16, 17-year-old student wrestling with this problem, and it's exactly what you're talking about. The first thing we got to do is figure out what questions can we ask and what answers do we know versus don't know.
I think that is... that is a great example. You're right. That is a great example. And by the way, you have me wondering, what does a solar chimney even look like?
I wish I was good with the verbal stuff.
You're a math
teacher. Well, what's funny,
you have a little bit of a pass. You're a math teacher.
It's like a chimney with a lot of glass.
It's a chimney with a lot of glass.
It's got some solar coating on the inside so that some of the windows kind of can accept this. There's a thing on the top that can accept some of the sun's rays. And the coating can reflect in ways that are really helpful for you. Now, I might lose my job with the solar chimney because I can't explain it correctly, but I don't have to fear that.
Very good. See, and by the way, how interesting that you, when you talk to people who you regard as brilliant, and they give you such different ideas on how to approach a problem.
Right.
It's a perfect illustration that there's often not one set way to do something, but that critical thinking. The word critical is there for a reason. Very interesting.
Well, I have a 6-week-old baby girl, and, buying books about sleep, there's a lot of different theories on the right way for them to sleep. So, these are life skills that you got to be able to figure out whose answer do you kind of get and can apply.
There's actually only one when it comes to parenting. There's only one. There's only one correct way and lots of wrong ways. Now, isn't that funny? I'm just absolutely just kidding. I have a 2.5-year-old, and my wife and I have learned over the last 3 to 4 years as you prepare for these things, there are many ways of doing things. And part of the challenge in these scenarios, whether you're dealing with a 6-week-old with sleep or a solar chimney, is or even the question of where to send a child to school. You don't have that advantage of seeing the variable. You often have to work within some difficult to ascertain parameters because you don't know what the alternative would have been. And that's another part that I think, again, that just forces us to be better thinkers. because we don't have the luxury of saying, well, I could do it this way, but if I did it this way, what would the answer be? You may not know that, you know?
Right. When I was in high school, I was a quiet kid in big classes, and it took me a long time to understand the value of asking for help and asking different people what they think about something, mm-hmm. and I'm still pretty bad at it. But that's one of the nice things about Harley are the relationships teachers have with their students. And as a young student, a young person, you start to learn the value of being open with different people and listening to different theories about the right way to do something and then trying to make sense of it on your own. You know, the younger age you can develop that skill, the better off you are in the long run.
I got a few more minutes with my guest to open Education Friday. It's Seth O'Brien, who is a math teacher and a Commons coordinator at the Harley School. It's an independent school, or you may call it a private school in our area. Seth, talking to us about the value of flexibility in education. And you mentioned for our listeners the living building. If we missed it, kind of tell us again what the living building is and how students get involved.
I've always been kind of, the living building phrase is a tricky one. The idea of the class and the programs at Harley is that we're trying to get the building to net zero energy use, minimize carbon, all that good kind of sustainability stuff, help the greater world eventually. And so we work together looking at energy use, growing things in the greenhouse, and trying to decide what's the best way to do something, what's the most efficient way to do something, what does best mean, how do you balance with like temperatures in the rooms, how do you balance being energy efficient with people being comfortable? Because if we're all freezing, we're probably not going to learn anything, and then what's the point anyway? So the living building is a class, there's clubs, there's independent studies, there's all millions of opportunities because of the flexibility in the curriculum for kids to get plugged in. And we're hoping in the long run to involve the general community as well. We want to be kind of a steward of sustainability in the community and moving forward with, you know, making the world a more hopeful future for environmental issues.
But there's one thing to teach out of a book, and then it's another to let people be hands-on. And mm-hmm. I think that's interesting, because it sounds like Harley has a lot of hands-on. And by the way, public schools are doing a lot of hands-on mm-hmm. too. I think they're realizing that value for students.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the beauty of some of our science classes is that a thing like the solar chimney actually uses scientific principles. So you can read the book about what convection is and then look right across your room and see the vent.
Actual
and be like,
practical application.
That's that heat coming in, right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and seeing the practical application, maybe I would have been a better chemistry student if I did just a little bit of that. My wife is a brilliant chemistry mind, and my goal in college was never to set foot in a building that had chemistry classes. So, but I never felt that. Anyway, so I've got only about 90 seconds, and this is Ben in the city of Rochester. Got to make it quick, Ben. Go ahead. Are you there, Ben?
I was wondering what the best way for a current Harley student.
Oh, you got to turn your radio down, Ben. See,
wondering what the best way for a current Harley student to become involved with all the programs, with all the time in the day, or if there is time in the day to become involved with all these programs, or if they have to pick. It sounds like there's a lot of great opportunities.
Thank you, Ben, and you've got to do this in just about a minute or less.
I think time management is really hard. It's a great point. There's a million things to be involved with. So sometimes if you want to be involved, maybe one can pick a small goal and say, help me figure out this little thing I can be involved with that would only take 30 minutes of my time every 2 weeks. And then you might have a manageable thing to be able to fold into the millions of things one already does.
Yeah, certainly I think, just observing, kids are more loaded up in schedules than even when I was in school. I don't know if you agree.
I totally agree.
And to some degree, that's great. The opportunities are great, but the overstructure for some families can be tough. Can be tough on the students, can be tough on the parents.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like you're at least cognizant of that.
Very.
And helping teach kids that. Seth O'Brien teaches at the Harley School, which is an independent school, a private school here, talking about educational flexibility. Really interesting stuff. Thank you for sharing a Friday afternoon with us, and you're generous with your time. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's a blast.
All right. Short break, and we're going to head over and talk to Andre Previn, a musical legend, joining us on this Education Friday. That's coming up next right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, an education in grape growing. This is the crucial time of year in the Finger Lakes wine industry, and a spectacular September might have saved the vintage. We'll learn what the growers are looking for as they get ready to harvest the fruit. Then we'll learn about the latest approaches in treating sleep apnea. It's all coming up next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Gardner Plus Architects, providing planning, architectural, and consulting services to the healthcare sector and other industries for more than two decades. Designing environments for the future, GardnerPlus.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A brand new work by Andre Previn will receive its world premiere by the Eastman Wind Ensemble this evening at the Eastman School of Music. Music for Wind Orchestra, No Strings Attached, will be performed as part of a series of events this week celebrating Mr. Previn's 85th birthday. His career has spanned seven decades and has included jazz, classical music, film music, conducting, teaching, and recording, along with four Oscars and 11 Grammy Awards. He tells WXXI's Mona Segetola-Slami that his career now has one main focus.
I have been concentrating on composing for the last 10 years or more. And I've written an awful lot in the last 10 years. And I enjoy it. I'm very lucky. I have a lot of commissions to fulfill. And this way, I have rather bad arthritis these days. And it's tough on me to travel too much. So I'm very happy to compose, which I can do absolutely anywhere. I don't have to get on a plane.
One of your famed compositions is for someone from our area, Renee Fleming. You wrote the opera Streetcar Named Desire. Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Well, I can talk for hours about Renee, because Renee is the best there is, and maybe the nicest. And we're very good friends. Yes, I wrote Streetcar Named Desire for her. And since then, I've written a lot of pieces for her. And in fact, right now, I'm writing a piece for her that she will do with the Emerson Quartet, and I'm crazy about her. She's really wonderful. She's a terrific musician, and so I look forward to all my work with her.
And most of your compositions, do you start with some idea of something of what you're trying to say through a piece, or is it the personal connections?
It's both, but I mean it's also. You know, money has to change hands with a commission, and that's part of it, too. But I have commissions that I have to fulfill from Renee, from the Emerson Quartet, from the Boston Symphony, from the Vienna Philharmonic, a lot of places.
And many of these orchestras you also worked with as a conductor.
Oh, yeah.
What do you enjoy about conducting and working with orchestras?
I think every musician wants to conduct. And, yes, it's great fun to conduct. I mean, it's not just fun. It's the best instrument there is, the orchestra. And I've been conducting a long time, a very long time. I also used to do commercial work. I used to conduct for films and for movies, but I don't do that anymore. I'm not interested in it. And for me, the best sound in the world is to hear an orchestra tune up. If I'm backstage or whatever, and I hear that A being bandied about the orchestra, I always find it thrilling, even now.
Do you have favorite composers or pieces or styles of pieces to conduct?
There's only one Mozart. And you can take everything else away, but Mozart we need.
In working with orchestras, also what goes into conducting besides directing traffic?
That's a very good thing to say, because many people forget about that, and you do have to direct traffic. But, an orchestra, a good orchestra, can tell whether you know what you're doing before you ever even give a downbeat. As soon as you get up, they expect you to know exactly what you want, and they expect you to have a thorough knowledge of all the instruments and how the piece is put together and whether it's a new piece or an old piece. If it were just directing traffic, there'd be even more conductors, God forbid.
And you alluded to working with movies. What got you into the movies and then out of the movies?
What got me out of the movies is just that I got bored with it, to tell you the truth. And I didn't really feel like writing music when I was a very old man to be played while Debbie Reynolds talks. But I got myself into the movies because I lived in California at the time. I was very young, and in those days they made so many films, and they were just looking for people to write the music. MGM had heard that I was capable and cheap, so they called me up, and I went to work, and I stayed there for a long time.
Did you consciously decide to learn all these different aspects, or did just how did it?
It just happens, you know. I mean, you pick things up, and you learn as you go. Now, I'm very old-fashioned about one thing. I know that a lot of my younger colleagues like working with computers. I don't. If I haven't picked up a pencil and put all those little dots down on music paper, I don't think I've written it. I think that the thing that I insist on with any students of mine is that they learn their craft. You know, it's one thing to have inspiration and all that, but you have to learn your craft. You have to know what you're doing. And once you do, you get the respect of the orchestra, and life's easier.
And so you do work with students. What are, besides making sure that they know their craft really well, what are the other things that you find to be really important on working with them?
Well, I know that a lot of them have the deepest respect for music, which is fine, but I'd like them to love it too. I think there's nothing beats loving the music. And if they do, and they at the same time learn their craft and have some kind of inspiration, they'll do very well. But it's only when they do it, oh, I tell you what, there are a lot of adults, if you like, parents, whose children play the piano, play the violin, play the viola, whatever, and they all have dreams of the kids becoming worldwide virtuosos. It's not necessary. If you learn an instrument or learn a compose or whatever, enough to give yourself pleasure and to give your friends pleasure, that's more than enough. You don't have to put on white tie and tails and play in Paris.
So do you enjoy the life, though, of white tails and ties and Paris and all that?
Yeah, I'd have to be foolish not to. But on the other hand, what I enjoy the most is the travel and the making the music. How fancy it is not so important.
We're speaking with Maestro Andre Previn, who is in Rochester for the world premiere of his new work, Music for Wind Orchestra, No Strings Attached. He'll also be receiving an honorary doctorate at this evening's concert. Let's hear a bit of his music. This is the fanfare from Andre Previn's Triolet for Brass. Fanfare from Andre Previn's Triolet for Brass, performed by members of the St. Luke's Chamber Ensemble. We're speaking with Mr. Previn about what fostered his initial love of music.
My father was a lawyer. He was not a musician, but he adored music. And he was a very good amateur pianist. And we had music in the house at all times. Chamber music and guests and people who came over and sang and did all kinds of things, and I just grew up with it. And my father also made sure that I learned to sight read very well and very quickly, and that meant that he and I could at night play four-handed versions of all the great symphonic works, and that's how I learned them to begin with when I was a kid. And it's funny because I've never even considered doing anything else. So I've always been of the opinion that a day without either playing music or listening to music or learning music is a wasted day.
Do you have certain things you come back to listening to again and again?
Oh, yes. There's too much to even go into. But, I mean, I can listen to endless amounts of chamber music, which I love. And Mozart, as I said before, is always welcome. And I never get tired of it. There's certain music which is, for the moment, fun, but you get sick of it. I know that I once went on a long tour with one of the orchestras that I ran, and we played several Prokofiev symphonies. And they're great pieces, but not every night. Whereas if you play the G minor Mozart or the Eroica or something, you never get sick of it.
And as a chamber musician, you played in a number of chamber music recitals. What music is your favorite to play?
I've played so much chamber music and with so many great people, and it's my favorite way of making music, because there you don't stand on a box and tell people what to do. You're actually playing it with them.
And when playing as a jazz musician, is that a sort of a form of chamber music too, or you generally play in small ensemble?
Yes, it's completely different, but it's fun to, that's really fun to do. You know, I mean, I played jazz when I was very young, and I don't play it as much anymore as I'd like to because I haven't got the time. But still, once a year I'll go and work, I don't know, at the Blue Note Club, you know, or something, either in New York or in Tokyo. And I get a good bunch of people together, and it's a wonderful way to relax. The idea of improvising all night is irresistible.
And do you have jazz recordings or composers or arrangers that you like listening to particularly?
There's all the pianists that I admire, you know, Bill Evans and Oscar Peterson and Art Tatum. But yeah, it's fun. Once in a while, I will put on, I don't know, a bunch of Billie Holidays or something, and it's a great way to spend an evening.
Could you talk a little bit about what is special about them to you?
No, I just envy them. They're wonderful and they play great. And I tell you something, people talk too much about music. You can talk it to death. You know, whether it's a Gesualdo Madrigal or Oscar Peterson. Enough, just listen to it.
You are going to be speaking with students at a talk at Eastman. What's the gist of your message that you want to share with music students?
No, I leave that pretty much to the students. I've done that a lot, and I find that once the first couple of questions have gone by and they're kind of stiff and formal, then they ask very interesting things. And also I make it a point to tell them that it doesn't have to be complimentary. You can also attack if you want to. You can say, how the hell do you get away with doing such and such? It's fine. So we'll see what happens.
I just love when the best story you seem to have, it seems really connected to the people you work with when you talk about music.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. You mean the people that I've actually conducted or played with or what?
All of that.
Oh, yeah. I tell you something, it's impossible to play chamber music with enemies. Can't be done. You have to be friends. And the more people you play with, the more friends you have. It's a wonderful life.
And we've talked a little bit about craft and inspiration. What is your inspiration to write concert works?
I like it when the organization or the person that's giving me a commission, whether it's musically interesting. Now, for instance, here, I was commissioned to write a piece for symphonic band. Well, I didn't know anything about it, so it interested me. I did a little research, listened to a lot of stuff, and I suddenly thought, okay, it might not be any good, but I'll try it.
Did you do anything different writing for students?
I made it harder.
That was Maestro Andre Previn speaking with WXXI's Mona Segetola-Slami. His newest work, Music for Wind Orchestra, No Strings Attached, will be performed this evening at Kilbourne Hall by the Eastman Wind Ensemble. And Mr. Previn will receive an honorary Doctor of Music degree from the University of Rochester during the concert. Education Friday rolls on here on Connections. We're about to learn how doctors are educating patients about all the options regarding sleep apnea. There are more options for treatment than you might think. And we'll get a lesson in viticulture as we explore the Finger Lakes grape harvest that's underway. It's all coming up.